Hello and welcome to Starting From The Pits. Joining me on this week's episode is John Hindhoff. For those of you who don't know, John Hindhoff is a legendary sports commentator and broadcaster. He is the managing director of Radio Show Limited, who produced Radio Le Mans and IMSA Radio, and is essentially the reason why I'm into endurance racing now. Known as the voice of Le Mans, John Hindhoff is certainly a name that you'll know, and if you don't know his name, his voice is certainly one that you'll recognise. I really hope you enjoy this conversation, and let's get into the episode. So, John Hindhoff, the one and only, welcome to Starting From The Pits. How are you?
I'm very well, Charlotte. How are you?
I'm great. How are you dealing with the jet lag from all of your travels this year?
I don't accept the premise of jet lag. And many years ago, a good friend of ours, David Brabham, he taught me a very, very important skill in that at the moment that you know that you are headed somewhere, so you've got to be a bit careful with this, because if you do it too early, it can cause problems in the airport. But okay, you put your watch on the time zone that you are going to.
Right.
And then, if possible, you eat, drink, and sleep. And that's the important one. But eating and drinking helps your body.
Okay.
And the rhythm of your body. And you do that for the time zone you're going to. Never, right, ever look at your watch and go, oh, it's 10 o'clock back home. I should be ringing. That is a killer.
I'm so guilty for that.
Well, we've all done it. We've all done it in our time. So that's not a problem. And the other thing, when I read President Clinton's book, he was interesting. So Brabs and President Clinton, strange couple of people to take advice from. But President Clinton said the joy of being the leader of the free world was that you never had to fly commercial. And at that point, take as many daytime flights as possible. Now, okay, so when I'm coming back from the US, I have a career when I'm finished in motorsport of doing a motorsport travel agency.
But okay, I know
every single flight from the East Coast to the UK that takes off first thing in the morning.
Right.
If you can take off first thing in the morning from the East Coast, or Chicago's good actually, because you get an extra hour back for that. That's on Central time. And then you get back to the UK 9-10 o'clock at night. You pick up your car, you drive home, you go to bed, and then you get up the next morning and bang, you're back on time. And,
genius.
And that's the only way I can work it. We've done, in the last few months, we've done huge, big time shifts, 19 hours of time shifts back and forth. If you look at this busy time of the year, from sort of December through January and February and now into March, which is where we are now, we're doing stuff in the Middle East, we're doing stuff in Australia, we're doing stuff in America, and bouncing backwards and forwards between all of those continents. That's the only way that you can keep it. And in fairness, I'm pretty clever about using my miles to get upgraded and get slightly nicer seats. And the other thing that really helps, and this is absolutely true, is with all the miles that I fly, I've got pretty good status, and it means I get access to lounges. And that does make a difference. It's much better when you've got an environment that you could work in, that you could eat and drink in, to a reasonable level, so that when you get on the flight, if they are trying to give you breakfast, when it's actually 5 o'clock in the evening where you go, you just go, no thanks, I've already eaten. And have a cup of tea instead or whatever.
That makes so much sense. So life hack there is to just book loads of flights.
Well, yes. I spent a very long time in the early days of the American Le Mans series, back in the 90s and the early 2000s, schlepping around on flights that never got me any status points and stuff like that. So the other thing is, if you're in the business and you're traveling, book your own flights.
Right.
Try and stay with one carrier or one particular group. And up until recently, Virgin and Oneworld, I was top class on in terms of the status, because it does make a difference.
Yeah.
Miles and status give you the opportunity to have a little more control over what you're doing. And because you've got to work, it's not like you're going out there 5 days before you've got to work.
Yeah.
Quite often you'll get off the plane, get in a car and drive to a track and be working either later on that day or first thing the next day. And that's why it's really important to try and get yourself on the right time zone as quickly as you can. So back time that as soon as you get on the plane. Don't do what I do and put you. I did once when I was coming home from Atlanta, I did put me watch forward to, forward to UK time. And then I nearly missed the flight.
Not ideal.
No, not good. No, not good.
Not good. So I feel like there's so much of your career that we could talk about, but let's start the beginning of it. What inspired you to pursue a career in motorsport commentary?
It will surprise you, probably not at all, to know that I never planned it.
That seems to be a case with a lot of motorsport people.
it sometimes just happens, doesn't it?
Yeah.
My original desire, if I was going to be involved in broadcasting, was I wanted to be a music radio DJ. I go back quite a long time, and so into the glory days of Radio 1 in the UK, the first national music radio station. And so the guys who were big on Radio 1 while I was growing up were people like Noel Edmonds, who was a genius, and Dave Lee Travis, and you know, all of those people, Simon Mayo, who's still around now. We've just lost Steve Wright, of course, as well, who was a genius broadcaster. All those people, Kenny Everett, when he was on the radio as well. These were the people that excited me because they were entertainers. They played music. I love music. Who doesn't love music? And they were entertainers. And they were doing it in a way that, without pictures. So they were painting pictures with words. When Noel Edmonds had his Sunday show, he created this whole aura of crinkly bottom, this old country house, and you could picture it. And everybody had a slightly different idea of what it was. And that was really clever. And it caught my imagination.
Got you.
So I was working, I never, at that point, I wasn't working in professional radio, but I had the opportunity. I blew out my right knee playing football, end of a very promising football career, I'll tell you that now, when I was in my mid-teens. And I carried on playing football, but I couldn't keep it up at the level that I wanted to. And whilst I was in hospital, I had my cartilage done. I listened to hospital radio, and hospital radio at the time, they did football commentary and football commentary of the greatest team in the northeast of England, which is obviously Sunderland AFC. From then at Roker Park, and they play music. And so when I came back out of that, I would have been just coming up to 16. I was leaving school. I left school far too early. Do your exams, kids. Get the pieces of paper. You never realise how important that is. My nieces and nephews hate me for that. And so I had some time. A lot of my friends went off to sixth form and to uni. And so I literally rocked up at Sunderland Hospital Radio in what was the old General Hospital, now called the Princess Royal Hospital in Sunderland. Still there, the hospital's still there, although the radio station's not based there. And I rocked up there and basically knocked on the door and, hello? is there anything I can do? And a lad called Graham Anderson said, come in, and sat me down, and there was all sorts going on. They had a pretty decent setup, actually a very good setup in those days. And part of the way through, he showed me the record library, told me the sort of stuff that they did. And part of the way through the evening, he said, just go in, sit in there and read this piece of paper. And he gave me, you know, a fool's cap sheet of paper, something like this, and said, right, read that. So, you know, and I went, okay, that was Tom Hancock. That was Tom Hancock and the Jazz Hour. And he'll be back next week at the same time. Coming up, we've got all your requests coming up on request time with whoever it was. And we've got, whatever the other program was.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, he's giving us a little bit of an audition.
Yeah.
So I came out and I said, and he said, no, that was fine. He said, what else can you do? Well, I said, well, I know a bit about music, and I like a bit of, you know, I've got a very eclectic taste. And
yeah.
And he said, all right, great. And I said, so what was all that about? He said, what was all what about? I said, that, you know, did you tape it or whatever? He said, no, that went out live. So I'd actually been on the radio without even realizing it. And that was my first introduction. When I was younger, I used to play records on my mum and dad's record player, and the record player had it's very, very old, and it had a big old-fashioned round microphone on it, and you could click it to sort of like having a PA. And if you got it halfway between record and PA, you could talk over the records, you know.
Oh, so, okay.
So it's a right now pop pickers, you know, all of the stuff that those people used to do in those days. And here's a smash hit from the Beatles, and all that stuff. And that's what I did. And so that got me into hospital radio. I learned quite a lot of the basics there about broadcasting and fundraising, which has always stood us in good stead. And that was really how I got the bug for it.
Yeah.
And we did, I mean, bizarrely, probably the first commentary I did was at a midnight mass on Christmas Eve in Sunderland.
They did commentary on that.
Well, you know, you have to do... We mic'd up the church,
okay,
and we ran a radio mic. We fixed up. This was also, by the way, at Hospital Radio, where I found clever ways of doing things, or ways that doing things that weren't necessarily expensive. And
work smarter, not harder.
Work smarter, not harder. Use what you've got. Okay.
Yeah.
And. So yeah, that was pretty cool. We did that, and so I was the guy saying, "Hello, everybody, and welcome to St. Peter's at Monk Weymouth." And in a moment's time, the Bishop of Durham, the Right Reverend, whoever it was, will be walking down the aisle, and we're just waiting for the crib to be completed with the arrival of the little baby Jesus. And the choir will be singing number 472, "Hark the Herald Angels Sing." And I mean that. So literally, that's what I was doing.
Yeah.
And we did various live events, and we did lots of fundraising, and we did things like air shows and firework displays, anything that would raise money, because it was all voluntary, of course.
Right. We
were trying to raise money for it. But it gave me a really good grounding in
Definitely.
The basics of broadcasting. And I was quite happy with that. And I'd done that for a little while. And I worked at a bank. I worked for the local public works department as a security guard and a driver.
Okay.
I did all kinds of weird and wonderful jobs. And then I started working in pubs and clubs and nightclubs in the Northeast, which is that's a great grounding, because you get to deal with live audiences all the time. And
gives you a really
good knowledge and sense of how far you can take something before the drunken guy that you're trying to slightly take the mick out of on stage in a 1200 people nightclub is going to turn around and smack you one.
Yeah.
So it's a really, self-preservation is a really good driver.
Got you.
To be honest.
Yeah.
But what it did was it allowed me to, I learned how to read people. I learned how to ask the cheeky question, get a bit of a laugh out of people. And it was all part of the learning process. And, you know, I went around the northeast and North Yorkshire and over into Lancashire doing promotions and marketing gigs for various people at work in men's clubs. And subsequently, I ended up being promotions manager at Metro Radio in the northeast of England.
Okay, cool.
Which was something slightly different. But again, that was great. We did... Metro did the first drive-in movie, big drive-in movie in the UK, and I was involved in all of that.
Wow.
And I had a really good commercial production manager, director, actually, a guy called Mike Burson.
Okay.
Go and look him up, because his philosophy and his teachings and his lecturing on how to use radio, the theatre of the mind, as he always used to call it.
Nice, I like that.
That has stayed with me forever and a day. He really underlined to me, and they were doing it in 30-second adverts. And Metro Radio's commercial production department won loads and loads of big and prestigious awards back in those days, and what they could do, what they could conjure up in a 30-second ad was quite remarkable, and that stuck with me. And I worked there for a few years. As I say, I ended up as promotions and marketing manager there. I did quite a lot of stuff for at the brewery at Newcastle. I ended up working in Edinburgh for quite a long time, doing fronting up the sort of comparing the Fringe Club in the the Edinburgh Fringe and the comedy festival. Again, always, you know, live audiences as well was always a big part of what I did. And long story short, I ended up getting, I went and helped actually on a Children in Need at BBC Newcastle, which was a regional centre in those days. And then, bizarrely, a few weeks after, a guy called Derm Tanner, who was the brother actually of Giles Tanner, Giles Squire was his on-air name, who I'd worked with at Metro Radio. He was our lead presenter. And Derm rang me up and said, hey, do you want to come and talk to us here at Radio Newcastle? And I thought it was to help them with the promotional side of things. And actually what they wanted was they wanted a Northeast accent on the radio. And so I went there, and ultimately, although I'd been broadcasting for a while, I think I'd probably started Radio Le Mans then. I would have been at Radio Le Mans for a couple of years. But they, I went down to London, and they took my whole knowledge apart and rebuilt it with the same building blocks that we try to instill in people now. But the Radio Le Mans thing came about because I met somebody through Metro Radio. They came, they wanted to use some of our promotion staff, and I got talking, and I spotted the jacket actually that Anthony was Anthony Landon was his name, and they had done the first Radio Le Mans a year or so before, and I'd been reading about it in motoring news, and and I asked him about it, and he said, oh well, would you like to come next year? And I said, well, yeah, that'd be great. You know, what can you do? I said, well, I've got loads of records and I can DJ a bit. And he said, oh, okay, great. Bring your records. We'll give you a shout. Nothing happened. And then in May, I get a phone call. No emails in those days. And basically, get yourself down to X, bring your records, and you're going to meet up with a guy called Harry Turner. And you and he will go to Le Mans together. We toured the studio down in a big old V8 Dodge day van. Harry ended up becoming a very good friend, and that's in fact who I ended up working with in Edinburgh as well on the promotion side of things. And that was me. That was 1989, Le Mans. And I've only missed one since.
That's unreal.
1991, I missed the Mazda year because I got chicken pox and I couldn't travel. I was very poorly with chicken pox.
Oh, God. Horrible.
Don't even want to tell. Adult chicken pox, not fun.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Spots in places you don't even want to talk about. I certainly couldn't talk to you about. And so, and I mean, that's it, really. That's kind of the potted history.
Whistle stop tour.
That's how it all started. And then, of course, the opportunities, because then you're there and you're doing it, other opportunities came along. So the American Le Mans series got started by Dr. Don Penos, God rest his soul. And he'd been and listened to Le Mans, Radio Le Mans in 96, 97, it would have been. And by then, I'd started working for Haymarket, who were then the publishers of Autosport. And it got to be my job to look after Radio Le Mans, which was sensible, as I knew it quite well by then. And I'd seen it go through a number of different iterations. And in, I think, probably 97, we did the deal with the ACO. Everybody always thinks the ACO give whoever is doing Radio Le Mans a whole load of money. It's quite the reverse. You pay the ACO for the rights to be called Radio Le Mans to do it. And then basically you have to raise the money commercially. That's still the same now. And They just upped the money quite a lot, and we realised we had to find a bigger audience than just who was there at the track to who were listening on FM. And we came up with this idea of putting it on the internet. And I mean, I'll be honest with you, Charlotte, I couldn't open a computer and turn it on back in 1996, 97. So we had to learn pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And with a bit of money from Porsche, who was still involved with us to these days, who paid for the ISDN lines, which are the high quality telephone lines you need. We only did, I'm pretty certain we only did the race on the internet that first year. Mm-hmm. And we used what I'm going to describe to you as spare bandwidth from some financial institutions in the city of London, the city of London, which had moved out by that time out to, to Docklands, or at least all the processing power had. And there was a couple of enthusiasts who said, if you can get us the audio, we've got some servers here that don't do anything over the weekend, long before 24-hour trading and things like that, back in 1996 or so. And so this spare bandwidth was how Reggio Lemon got on the internet.
Spare.
The first year. Spare. I'm leaving the names out to protect the absolutely fantastic, because without it, it would never started. And we didn't really advertise it that much because we didn't know what to do. But we had, organically, we had a decent audience. But that was beep, 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 blah, 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 dial-up internet in those days. So completely different. But that set us on a road that really, I would love to say that I was super clever and that we foresaw what was going to happen with the internet revolution. Mm. It just so happened we were there. I mean, nobody else was doing stuff on the internet back in those days. And when Don Panos heard it and saw it, he got one of his guys to ring us up and rang me up on my fairly new mobile phone in those days. I had one of those StarTAC Motorolas.
Love those.
I still got it somewhere, I bet. And I always want, Scotty, beam me up. That was the what I loved about it. Fucking
yeah.
Sure, my age there. And we got this idea. Don Panos had got this idea. He was going to do a race in the same vein as Le Mans in the 24 hours. And it was Petit Le Mans. So in 1998, we went across the water to the States with some equipment. We begged and borrowed and hired, no stadium involved, some more equipment. And we set up a radio station and played it out on the internet, which went well. And Petit Le Mans morphed fairly quickly into, in 1999, the American Le Mans series.
Right.
And not only did Dr. Dunn want us to broadcast all of that, but he wanted us to build him a website. So we got the people together, we built a website, we were doing digital images, which nobody was doing. Gary Dodds, a good mate of mine, who's a very good photographer, still works in the computer business, GFD computers up in Rye, up in Sunderland. Ever need a good games machine building, he's your man.
Keep it noted.
He came over and we got some Canon lenses. We borrowed a Kodak camera. Kodak did do digital cameras and they never believed in it enough. And it absolutely ruined the company. The first one we got two camera backs, which were about this big by about that deep.
Right.
And they were insured at $50,000 each.
Oh my gosh.
Now, I promise you won't laugh when I say that. They were all of 1.2 megapixels.
I'm not laughing.
Just incredible. At the end of the year, they took them away from us and crushed them and gave us the funky new version, which was 2.5 megapixels. Ooh. And the cost had come down, or the value had come down to 30 grand. And we kept them for a few years. Ultimately, we graduated to all Canon gear.
Yeah.
But we were posting digital images, we were doing live sound, we were doing clips, we were even encoding video and putting that onto there. And that was back in 1998. There were some very clever people working with us in those days. But what that did do, Charlotte, was it meant that instead of doing one event a year and trying to move on and understand, we were then all of a sudden doing an event a month, pretty much.
Right.
And 10 events from Sebring through to Petit Le Mans from March through to October. And so you make more mistakes, you learn more, and you push the technology further. And that was, I mean, those first few years were incredible. It did have an effect on what we were doing at Le Mans.
Yeah.
And it culminated in 2006, when the American Le Mans series were probably not quite at its height. It was just starting to come down, but we'd had all the glory years of the American Le Mans series. Remember, there was no WEC. There was no World Endurance Championship at that time. There didn't need to be, because all the best sports car teams in the world were in the American Le Mans series. It was a de facto World Championship. It was incredible racing. And in 2005, at the end of 2005, Haymarket and Autosport decided they didn't want to take up their option on Radio Le Mans with the ACR. And it looked very much like Radio Le Mans was going to die. And so I said then to my then married then. No, we weren't married. So my then fiancé, Eve, now my far better half, and obviously the responsible adult without whom we can't get public liability insurance to do anything, as a bunch of blokes who are into motorsport. I said to Eve, we got to do something here. And we did. We tried to do a couple of commercial deals and we got really close and then nothing happened. And as luck would have it, I'd moved down to from the Northeast to the Midlands. I worked for Ray Mallock for a couple of years, which was brilliant, at RML at Wellingborough. And so I'd rented out my house up in the Northeast and then decided to sell it. And that sale had just come through. It was meant to buy a classic racing car. But instead, I basically gave all the money to the ACO for the first contract for Radio Le Mans. And so we went to Le Mans in 2000. We committed to it at the end of 2005. They asked for the first tranche of money between Christmas and New Year 2005. That was half of the money that we required to give them. And then the rest had to be paid before test day. And we didn't have a single sponsor. And God bless them, Audi UK and a chap called David Ingram, who'd always been a brilliant supporter of Radio Le Mans when I was at Haymarket and working with them and raising money at that. David had supported us. And I rang him up and I said, David, Haymarket's not involved, so it's going to be a bit different. Do you still want to be involved? And he said, who's running it? I said, me and Eve. And he said, yeah, we're in. And it was, I mean, it was literally as simple as that. And without that, we probably wouldn't have got past the first year. And that really was the real start of what we do now as Radio Show Limited. We had to form, the ACO asked us to form a limited company. So that's why RSL, Radio Show Limited, came about. Also a play on restricted service license, which was what I had done many, many years before and understood about that. And that basically, that started it. And from that one event that we were doing at Le Mans, we did 76 events last year in 2020.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That is some growth.
Over 22 million downloads and about 8,000 hours of live.
That is insane.
So it's only taken us since 2006 to become an overnight sensation.
That's the case with a lot of things, though. People think it takes off overnight, and it really doesn't. It takes so much years of building and growing that audience.
And you have to have a bit of good fortune. We were in at the beginning, so as I said, we'd made the mistakes. And when we had the opportunity to take on other events, other series, etc., we were able to do that and expand. And it should be said that we did it with a team of people who are outstanding. When we started, there were very few of us. In fact, I think I was the only person who'd done professional broadcasting when I first started going to Le Mans. It was, you know, and it was just once a year on FM. Then everybody else did something else the rest of the year and came to Le Mans. So you had people like Paul Truswell, ace statistician and, you know, absolute cornerstone of what we do to this day. He was in IT, Ian Titchmarsh, one of the commentators, PA commentator. Harry Turner was in the pits. Martin Haven was in the pits for us. He was a broadcaster. He wasn't a radio broadcaster. But other people that we brought in Subsequently, Graham Tyler, Fingers as he was known, because he made his living as a masseur for quite a long time, a sports masseur. Joe Bradley, ex-policeman, or was a policeman actually when he was working for us. Nick Damon had worked in the pit lane for Bernie Vision for Formula One for 8 and a bit years.
Right.
Bruce Jones, see above comment, and former editor of Autosport.
Okay.
But we took people who had, in those early days, through the Autosport years and even in the early RSL years, we took people who had enthusiasm, who had energy, who had emotion about the sport and knowledge, because I reckoned I could, if they needed the rough edges, not in terms of broadcasting, I can teach them broadcasting. I can't teach them how to be enthusiastic about 100%. Sports cars. You have to have that. You've got to live it. Which is, you know, how we got Shea Adam involved, because her dad, Bill Adam, and I worked together. He was an ex-sports car driver and a very good broadcaster. Shea's mum, the brilliant Diane. Diane Magnum is her work name. Network news anchor in Florida. So Shea had all the right background, and she'd been steeped in motorsport. She was working in the graphics department of TV.
Right.
And Eve and I sat around and we decided we needed some extra people for Le Mans one year. So we took Shea to Le Mans, and I remember giving her the microphone at the scrutineering weekend and saying, right, you've seen me do a couple of interviews, your turn now. So I basically, you know, did the thing and said, so we're here, 91.2 FM, it would have been Mobile One Radio Le Mans back in those days. Mobile One Radio Le Mans. And here's Shea Adam with another interview. Who have you spotted, Shea? And she takes the mic and says, ah, Dindo Capello. Dindo, come over here. So this is your last Le Mans then? And I thought, right, that's mine. I'm fine. I'm not needed here anymore. If that's going to be your first ever question on Radio Le Mans, and Dindo just burst out laughing. And it was like, well, if you've got the chutzpah to do that, you're fine.
Yeah, fine.
And you know, clearly Shea, she's as good in the booth as she is in the pits. Incredibly versatile broadcaster. She works for other people as well now, rightly so. And all of our people that have come through us down through the years. Joe does a whole load of historic stuff, does some karting now as well. Although, in fact, Joe and I did some karting way back in the years, but hopefully that tape never surfaces. We weren't polished, I don't think. So it's been an interesting journey, Charlotte, and it's been lovely to bring people along and been able to involve people who are of the same mind and the same enthusiasm that we have.
And I think that's how it works so beautifully. And I remember, obviously, the first race that I've watched with you commentating was the Daytona 24 this year.
All right.
And being able to listen to you all made it so easy for me to watch and listen. And I felt, even as a new fan, very involved in it, because you can feel your passion coming across. And I think that's genuinely what helped me fall in love with it so much. And it just, it comes across. And I think the fact that it isn't, you know, perfect, you know, you all... You have the background in motorsport, and that's what makes it what it is.
The thing that we have to be careful about, and it's a very fine line, is that, so there's you watching Daytona this year, which was a great Daytona, a little bit of tire saving early on, and then hell for leather at the end in all the classes. Really interesting. We have a line, as I say, to tread between you watching your first ever big sports car race and needing to understand what's happening and the differences between the classes and the strategy that's playing out, because you're doing, the GT cars are doing a full Formula One race each time they go out and come back in again. The P2s are having their own battle. The GTP cars, in that case, the LMDHs, they're having their own battle. And sometimes they get out of kilter with each other. So you're seeing things that change. So we have to be able to explain that to you without talking down to the hardcore fans who, I'll be quite honest with you, Charlotte, probably have more information at their fingertips than we do have in the booth.
Yeah.
You know, Yes, at Daytona, I look out of the window and I can see the whole track. Very unusual for a sports car or, in fact, a motorsport commentator. I think there's three tracks that we go to around the world where that is the case. Daytona, okay. Dubai and Kuwait. Those right. are the three where we have the best views. Normally, you're sitting in... Well, funny enough, we were just talking about this at the weekend at Qatar. The guys normally who do the WEC TV, they sit in a container. And they don't, right. So they've only can't got see anything. They can't see anything. At Kota, for example, if you're on the ground floor commentary boxes, the local fire engine park's right outside. So you can't even see the cars coming in to the pits because the local Texas Fire Brigade are there at the Circuit of the Americas and they park right in front of the last commentary booth. You need to be one or two floors up to even see a tiny bit. So we have a really tough job to be able to remind ourselves that probably 50% of our audience can't see the pictures or can't see the whole circuit, at least. I mean, that's particularly obvious when you're at Le Mans, which is 8.5 miles around, or the Nürburgring, you know, 15 odd kilometers just for the North Loop.
Yeah.
That you've got an ever-increasing audience. And this is a part of motorsport that continues to increase. It continues to bring younger fans in as well, like yourself. This is not aging out. It's incredible how many people, and people tell me that the young fans don't have an attention span for endurance racing. That is nonsense.
Absolutely not.
That is nonsense. It's an insult to the fans, actually, and to people of your age. I understand the TikTok generation and firing into something and looking at it for 5 seconds and going, no, gone. But when somebody wants to sit down and commit, and like I said, there's a lot of fans who have got the international TV, which is our audio, or if they're in the States, they might be watching NBC, but they'll have our audio on sync to that so that when they go for breaks or they change channels, they don't lose the flow of the race. Then they'll have some onboard cameras because they're available through IMSA.TV. And then they'll have a timing screen or two timing screens and a tablet that's got a strategy program running on it. And then they'll have a chat in Discord or RWEC or something like that, where they're swapping each other. Now, if for those of you who understand Discord, if you're on the RWEC group on an IMSA race or a WEC race, particularly the IMSA races, there's two versions of it. You can run the standard version or you can run the slow version. And the slow version is literally so you can have time to read the messages. Because if you don't, it's just spooning around so quickly. And those fans know as much about the racing as any of us, sometimes more, because they're sometimes plugged in very closely to a team or a driver.
Right.
And as I say, they'll probably have more screens. We've got what we can see out the window. We've got what's going to air. Mm-hmm. And we'll have a couple of timing screens. Pretty much all of us now will run a laptop and I run a laptop and a secondary screen as well for things that I need to see. But a lot of that is not necessarily straight to the race. That'll be that'll be social media. So what used to be called TweetDeck, X Pro. It'll be a Skype chat in text with London. And then Eve will be firing us stuff that's coming off information that's coming from WhatsApp groups, from the teams, etc., and putting stuff in front of us and all that sort of stuff. So quite often we don't have as much information as the fans. And so we've got to bear that in mind. So, and you will miss things.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you'll be looking the other way or whatever. But we've got a nice set of people. We call it the collective. They call themselves the collective. Mm-hmm. And I always talk about collective knowledge.
Yeah.
And what's nice about it, Tom Christensen's book actually sums this up brilliantly in his book about his career. And there's two paragraphs in there, and I can't remember them word for word. I should have brought it, actually. And he basically says it always throws him out that he's done a 24-hour race, and everybody he talks to has seen the same 24-hour race, but the recollections of it are all slightly different. It is a shared experience, but everybody's experience is a little bit different. And that kind of, I really connected with that when Tom put that in words.
Yeah.
Because It takes me back to my Metro radio days and Mike Burson writing commercials where he was creating pictures in people's heads.
Yes.
And everybody would see something slightly different. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've got to do for those who can't see the pictures, whilst not insulting the people who can see the pictures.
Yeah.
There's no point in me, you know, looking across to a screen and going, ah, the bright red Ferrari is going down to turn one and turning left.
Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah.
Add to the pictures. Some of my favorite things to tell people not to say is look at that, because obviously if you've got the pictures, yeah, you can't see it. If you haven't got the pictures, you can't look at,
yeah,
it. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So tell me where it is. Tell me who it is. Tell me why it's important. Tell me what's happening. We're on board with. No, you're not. You're not on board with.
Yeah.
If you'd say that in TV. Oh, let's jump on board with so-and-so. No, you're still in the commentary box.
Yeah.
Still there. We're making our way through turns 10 and 11. No, no, they are.
You're, yeah, not. We're not.
And I know that's slightly pedantic, but particularly for people who can't see the pictures or can't see anything, we have a lot of people who are vision impaired who listen to what we do.
Yeah.
And some of the most humbling things that we get told about our coverage is that they have the pictures as vividly as you and I would be watching them on television, because we talk about the blue and red car on the, yeah, outside and the yellow and green car on the outside, on the inside, trying to go into turn two,
yeah,
at so-and-so. And it's really important to remember not to be too clever. And it might, yeah, you and I might know that the third car back is Nick Tandy. Mm-hmm. But if you just say, oh, there's Nick Tandy going past and taking third, well, even if you're watching the pictures, who's Nick Tandy? Which,
yeah,
car is he driving?
Yeah,
Nick Tandy,
yeah,
in the red and white car, that's the number six Porsche that's, yeah, going past the black and blue number 10, which is the Acura of Wayne Taylor Racing. Well, then it places it on the screen,
yes,
particularly if there's lots of action going around. And it's these little things that I think make a difference and help.
Definitely.
They are subtle, and not everybody does it, not in our sport and not in other sports commentary either. But it's why we choose the people we do, because they, yeah, understand that and they embrace it. And bear in mind, Charlotte, when we do IMSA, so that IMSA broadcast that you were watching,
yeah,
our audio was being used at the track on the PA and on the local radio station.
Yeah.
On Sirius XM as a standalone broadcast. They've got 33 million subscribers in the US.
Wow.
To the international feed as well that you're watching, which is a TV feed,
mm-hmm,
and of course to our global RS2 IMSA radio feed. So you're multitasking that audio, and it has to work for all of them. TV,
yeah,
commentary without TV pictures doesn't work. Look at that.
Yep.
Oh, I've never seen anything like that before. when there's a graphic on the screen, somebody going, that's really interesting. Those statistics really tell a completely different story to what we've seen in the race. What,
yeah,
statistics are you talking,
yes,
about? If you're just listening, that doesn't,
yes,
work. So it's things like this that I'm saying this to you now. It seems very obvious.
No, but when you're watching, it makes a big difference.
Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely,
yeah,
right. I'll have to ask you a question then. So did you enjoy Daytona, and how much of it did you watch?
I love Daytona. So I was thinking about this as you were talking earlier. I sometimes switch off a little bit during Formula One races. I will admit that. And this weekend I was like, don't have a nap. You don't need to have a sleep. It's fine. But during IMSA, I was locked and loaded on the screen pretty much all day long. I tried to pull an all-nighter. I've never pulled an all-nighter in my entire life. Didn't pull through with that one. But no, I watched, I'd say, I can't even get the number of how many hours I watched it, but I watched it for a lot of hours.
It's very important to work out your food and drink intake. And you can't have too much coffee earlier on, because then it won't work when you really,
yeah,
need it. Don't eat a lot of carbs, because those make you sleepy. So protein's good. Anything,
okay,
with a lot of dopamine in it, green vegetables, that sort of stuff. Water, but not too much water, because then you've got to run the loo all the,
yeah,
time.
You might miss something.
And you'll miss something. Of course you will. That's absolutely the case. Well, I'm delighted that we've brought you into the sports car fold, and,
yeah,
that you're enjoying it. We've just finished the WEC at Qatar, an historic sweep of the podium for Porsche, and the first wins for LMDH cars in the current rule set. I don't think that it's been a very long time since a WEC race was swept. One of the first year ones, 2012, Audi did it. But that was an extraordinary race. 37 really impressive entries in the WEC. We'll have further coverage of that all the way through the year. Next up for us is Sebring, another American classic.
Yeah.
Just a mere 12 hours. So we won't even work shifts for that. We'll work all the way through that. The 12-hour wow. races. We tend to work through straight through. Which will be about 13 hours by the time we've done Michelin Countdown to Green and Michelin Post Race Tech. So that, if you're in the UK, once again, you'll be able to get that on the world feed through IMSA.tv and through IMSA.IMSAradio.com. I know it sounds odd having pictures on a site that's called IMSARadio.com, but they're there as well.
No,
so
I get it.
I do hope you'll want to join us for that.
Definitely will do. And I appreciate we've gone over time a little bit, but do you mind if we do a quick fire round?
Of course, fire away.
Amazing. So, first off, do you have any rituals or routines that you have before going on air?
Not so much now. I like to be settled and in position quite early. So at Bathurst recently, we weren't on the air till 5:30 in the morning. Even though it meant getting up early, I was in the studio before 5 o'clock, just setting myself up, getting myself comfortable. Didn't move. I didn't move out the booth for that one. That was another one we didn't move for. I prefer to sit or stand. I'd mostly do my commentary standing up on the left-hand side of everybody else. So I like to have my co-commentators and my guests on the right-hand side. I don't know where that started, although at the weekend, interestingly, I set up the other way around and I had all my guests on the left-hand side of the gutter, which I've only just realised, and that's actually just given me a little shiver. you have to be comfy. So tend to wear dark coloured clothing if you can, so you don't get reflections off the screen.
Right.
You've got to be comfy. No point in having tight pants and stuff like that on, because if you're standing or sitting for 12 hours, and also a good pair of shoes.
Yeah.
Bring, if you're doing shift work for Le Mans, make sure you bring a clean pair of socks with you.
Right.
You cannot believe what a difference a clean pair of socks in the middle of a 24-hour race can do.
That's the nichest thing ever.
Tiffany Dell taught me that one on my first Le Mans, when we were standing in a queue to go and have a shower in the middle of the night at the back of the old tyre paddock. Things were way different in those days. He was driving, I was broadcasting, and that was the first time I met Tiff in the line for the showers at the back of the gents toilets at Le Mans. But we'll probably want to gloss over that. He won't thank me for reminding everybody that. So and make sure you've got water, and if you need snacks, then you know, make sure they're well sorted out in advance. Normally we have a studio manager who helps with things like that.
Well, next quick one is favorite snack or drink to keep you going.
Water, and then never underestimate the great restorative issues that you can have. Didn't mean issues, do I? Of a good cup of tea,
right?
But and I drink tea black with no sugar. But I have become very much associated with having a cup of coffee in the middle of the night and a bit of dark chocolate. Through motorsport, we've been introduced to Tubbs and Sacred Coffee, and he makes sure that we've got supplies when he can get them to us when we're at racetracks. If
Sounds
not,
amazing.
We try to. He's linked up with Porsche and Penske, so okay. we almost always find some of his capsules or some of his ground coffee, and quite often we travel a coffee machine with us.
Fair enough.
Snacks wise, dark chocolate's great.
Yeah, I love dark chocolate.
Just little squares of it just to get you through. But like I say, you've got to try to stay off is carbs. Carbs are your enemy. They're great at the time, but then you get what we call the carb coma.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden,
you want to sleep.
Yeah.
Perfect. So Daytona or Le Mans?
Am I driving or am I talking?
Talking.
You can't pick. It'd be like trying to pick between two children.
I had a feeling you'd say that.
Or two Porsches. All of the 24-hour races that we do, Charlotte, have in common, they are 24 hours long.
Mm.
And yet they all have a slightly different character and atmosphere. So yeah. The 24 hours of Dubai, I love that race. It's great. It kicks off the season. Daytona, you've got that huge amphitheater and it's big and it's brash and it's American and it's great racing. And we always have a great finish because of the way American racing works. And you might get a safety car, but when you don't get a safety car and you get 5 or 6 hours of green flag racing, it's sensational. You get the 24 hours of the Nürburgring. Oh, the Nürburgring.
Yeah.
It's basically Glastonbury for motorsports, except spread around 12 and a bit miles of circuit.
Insane.
The Germans are nuts for it. And
yeah.
Again, it's a different type of racing because the top class there is GT3. So
right.
They all have the Creventic 24-hour race at Portimao this year. I'm looking forward to again because Portimao is such a great circuit.
Mm.
Barcelona, we do a 24-hour race. They all have a slightly different personality. Le Mans was my first 24-hour, and it's what I'm best known for.
But yeah.
All of those races have a very special place in my heart.
Okay, perfect. I love that. Do you prefer talking over day or night?
There's something about nighttime racing.
Yeah.
When I grew up listening to sports on the radio, sometimes you would get heavyweight boxing fights in Las Vegas, and that would be overnight. And that would be me in my bedroom with a little earpiece in, hoping I didn't wake my mum and dad up, listening to a chap called Eamon Andrews, who was much more famous for doing This Is Your Life, but he was an incredible sports and boxing commentator. And something about sport when it's dark,
yeah,
particularly when you're in the dark, and motor racing in the dark for me is slightly... it's slightly illicit. It's almost, it's like, oh, we shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah, it's got another element of danger in there, hasn't there?
And also the cars sound different at night. There's a genuine difference. And there is a scientific reason for this, which people much cleverer than me will know, but it's about the density of the air. So
oh,
when
right.
we record cars are running in daytime at Daytona and running at nighttime at Daytona, there is a subtle difference to how the sound reverberates because the old drag racers used to call it when the air was heavy, when the air was thicker,
right.
They call it fat. The air was fat because there'd be more oxygen in it and therefore they could turn up the wick on the drag cars. Well,
right.
When the air gets fat, when it gets thicker and more dense, then the cars sound different. And it's just, I mean, I've been very fortunate to have raced a couple of times in darkness.
Mm.
And racing in darkness with just your headlights, oh, it's incredible.
Really?
And you've seen the onboards.
Yeah.
At Daytona, it's not even dark. But when you go to Le Mans, there's very, very dark places. Out at Dubai, until recently, they've put a few lights up now at Dubai, but the far side of Dubai, I mean, it is literally pitch black. And
yeah.
That, to me, it requires a special skill.
Definitely.
So it's always, I'll take the darkness shifts. I quite often do up until 2 o'clock in the morning at Daytona and at Le Mans. So you get, at Le Mans, you're just about getting dark at that point because it's obviously in the middle of the year.
Yeah.
It's incredible. I love darkness racing.
Love that. So do you prefer Porsche or Toyota?
Well, I own Porsches.
of course. I should have known.
Again, it's difficult because although Toyota don't have the history, without Toyota, there would be no World Endurance Championship. When Peugeot originally pulled out, Toyota very bravely decided to come and enter a car, even though it wasn't really ready. They deserve, if you can say anybody deserves everything, they deserve all the success they've had. But when you look at Porsche, what I look at Porsche as a company, Porsche to me are an engineering company. First and foremost, they were an engineering company and they ended up building cars. And they're still, to a greater extent, there's still an element of that to today. I mean, it's a hugely different company from when it was formed and when the 356 first came out. But when you look at the way they've managed to keep the 911 pretty much unchanged in its philosophy, if it's not its size and weight and its power, for 60 years plus, I've never lived in a world where there was no 9/11. Me and the 9/11 are pretty much the same age. And there's just something about their engineering excellence. And in fairness, Toyota have gone down exactly the same way. Toyota and their motor racing program is paid for by Road Car Research and Development, which I think is unique. It's normally marketing, but Toyota understand that you go motor racing to improve and to learn and to then feed that into your road cars.
Yeah.
And so actually there's a lot more synergy between Toyota and Porsche than people would think. And Toyota have actually produced probably my very favorite Le Mans car, which was the GT1, which never won at Le Mans. It should have. GTONE. Tony Southgate, among us others, were involved in designing that. It should have won at Le Mans, got a puncture when it was leading with about half an hour, 35 minutes to go. And I was on the air for that. Fantastic red, white and black livery. Just an incredible car. Go and look it up.
I will. I definitely will be. And who should we be looking out for this season?
In what? In IMSA or in WEC?
Let's go WEC.
Right. WEC is going to be very open this year. We've seen already that the status quo has been upset a little bit, which will upset Toyota followers and fans. I think that that championship in both the manufacturers and the drivers could actually go all the way to Bahrain. Le Mans will play an important part because there's double points there.
Yeah.
But in the top class, you've got 19 cars and only the top 10 score points.
Right.
So there's only 8 races, 7 plus Le Mans. And I think pretty much every manufacturer is going to have, if not every team, if not every car, will have one bad race where they potentially don't score. So that's going to be really interesting. I think Alpine have made a good start for the best of the newcomers, which you can't say about the Formula One team, unfortunately.
Unfortunately not.
maybe they should take a little bit of inspiration from what they're doing with the guys in there, with Philippe Signeaux and the guys from Signatec who have been helping them out. I also think that there's a lot of improvement still to come from people like WRT and BMW in the top class.
Yeah.
Toyota won't be out of it for long. Cadillac will always be there, and Ferrari. Mm. Oh, hang on, that's more than half the field.
Yeah.
And in GTs, Aston Martin have had a good start. Porsche have had a good start. Watch out for improvements from both Ford and Corvette, who I don't think were overly happy with their debuts, and the same with Lexus as well. So again, pretty much everybody of the 18 cars that are in that field could have a shot at it. In IMSA, well, Porsche are on a roll, having won at Daytona, but you won't keep Acura down for long. So watch both of the Acura teams watch the two Acuras from Wayne Taylor and Andretti Racing as well. They've got a point to prove. The Cadillacs there as well also are going to be good. And in the GT categories, again, watch for Ford and Corvette to challenge the established teams there. I think Sebring will be very interesting because that should give us a real... Daytona is a bit of an outlier because of the track. Sebring, you might say, is an outlier because of the bumps, but you will get an idea of where the form is after Daytona before we head to WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca.
Amazing. Well, I feel like that's a really great way to round up this episode. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like we've gotten such a good insight into this entire world that you're part of. It's been great.
Charlotte, it's been an absolute pleasure. Good luck with what you're doing with the whole project. Congratulations on getting it up and off the ground, because that's the hardest thing to do. And speaking to somebody who, we're now in our 19th season of Midweek Motorsport, which is a weekly show on the Wednesdays, you know, at 8 o'clock in the UK on RS1. Mm-hmm. It's a hell of a commitment to keep doing it. I hope you keep your passion. And let us know if you're going to be at a racetrack that we're at anytime soon, and come and see us in action, won't you?
Definitely. Absolutely will. Thank you.